Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book. Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everybody. And welcome to another episode of NBN's Drugs, Addiction, and Recovery podcast. I'm your host, Geert, and with us today is Professor Alison Ritter to discuss her book, Drug Policy, just published with Routledge. The ink is barely dry, I believe. Just briefly, Professor Ritter is an internationally recognized drug policy scholar and the director of the Drug Policy Modeling Program at the University of New South Wales. She is also a senior research fellow leading a multidisciplinary program of research on drug policy. And she worked as a clinical psychologist in the alcohol and drug treatment sector prior to commencing full-time research. Furthermore, she's past president of the International Society for the Study of Drug Policy, and currently she is an editor-in-chief for the International Journal of Drug Policy. It's quite the list. Welcome, Professor. I'm so glad you're here.
Thank you very much for having me.
Let's start right here. Alison, what did you aim for writing the book Drug Policy? Is there a particular problem that you thought about solving?
There are many problems in relation to drugs and drug policy globally. The main motivation for the book really was to try and bring together four different theoretical perspectives that are used and to try and put them all together in one place and, in a sense, to begin the opportunity for these perspectives to speak to each other. And those, just briefly, those four perspectives are evidence-based policy, a popular position that our drug policy should be evidence-based. The second is policy process theories. So this is how policy gets made. That comes from a different tradition that comes from public administration and public policy. The third is democratic theory. And the fourth is post-structural policy analysis. And so really the motivation for the book was to try and be able to position something like post-structural policy analysis alongside evidence-based policy, alongside democratic theory, alongside policy process theories, and to do that in such a way that it's accessible and in a sense it's the start of a conversation rather than the end of a conversation.
I was reading, and yeah, the four perspectives come to the fore very clearly. At the same time, it surveys like a wide range of empirical and theoretical research. So, to me, it also was a bit of an introduction into the field of drug policy analysis. When I write summaries or introductions, or if I write syntheses of academic texts, sometimes it does lead to like personal new syntheses of knowledge. You know, were there any things, any facts, or any patterns that struck you particularly when you wrote the book or when you finished it?
these are themes or theoretical perspectives that I've been working with for many years. And in a sense, the book is a synthesis of both my own work, the work of my team, plus work of colleagues across the globe. And it certainly is global in terms of its content. So I guess there's not something that surprised me in the process of writing it or something new that emerged from writing it. I do know what I want to work on next, though, if that's partly an answer to
Definitely. Tell us, please.
Question. So I want to do more on values and ethics. I think we haven't paid enough attention to that. I've done some initial preliminary, you know, some empirical work. I know there are people in the UK and in other places who are interested in looking at the role of values in relation to drug policy. So I'm very keen to pursue more along that line.
I see. And who exactly is the audience that you wrote the book for? Like, whom in the field of policy would you like to hand it out to first?
Everybody. No. I think it is an overview and an introduction. And in that sense, I'm speaking to people who are beginning to study drug policy and people who are already studying and engaged in drug policy. One of my career missions is to make everybody a drug policy scholar and to attract people to the field, to attract undergraduates and postgraduates, because we need the next generation of people to help solve these complex problems. So I would hope that students of criminology, of sociology, of law, of public health pick this up and think, wow, I could do some work in relation to drug policy. So that's, in a sense, I guess, one of the audiences. But governments are also an audience. I mean, governments have an enormous responsibility and burden to try and get this right. And more often than not, they don't get it right. And I would hope that people in the public service and bureaucracies read it and perhaps think more purposefully about the goals of drug policy and what they're doing and what the impacts of those choices have in people's lives.
That's interesting that that governments don't get this right. I mean, isn't it that the public servants, so to say, are drug policy or are policy?
I don't quite understand the point.
You say that quite often the public servants and governments don't get drug policy right, perhaps how policy is made. But aren't they the primary actors? So how might it work that they don't get it right what they are doing?
Oh, you're asking me about why drug policy has failed.
No, it's more how governments themselves don't understand or don't sufficiently understand the policy setting process, the cycle.
Oh, I mean, I think they understand the process. Their problem is the content. Sorry. But yes, of course. They understand perfectly well how decisions get made and they understand the role of evidence, extremely limited, the role of ideology, extremely high, and the electoral cycle and the windows of opportunity. They understand all of that. The challenge is for them to have a goal around what to do about drugs that they can successfully implement in the context of understanding those processes. So So the problem for academics is that many academics don't understand the process of policymaking. They see it as a simple, linear, we generate empirical evidence, we give it to a decision maker, and a decision maker chooses the policy that's based on evidence. And the academic's job is to generate evidence and translate it. That's not how policy gets made at all. And, there's a lot of text about that in the book. So the policymakers understand how policy gets made, but what they're missing is the content of drugs and choosing a goal. So one of the real challenges, I think, is deciding whether you're interested in reducing the harms from drugs or in reducing drug use per se. Now, they're not mutually exclusive. Clearly, if you don't use drugs, you're not going to experience harm. But the policy settings around reducing harm are very different from the policy settings around reducing drug use. And the lack of establishing a clear goal by decision makers, I think, then creates the opportunity for poor policy, basically.
Is there, you've already mentioned these potential policy goals that if they are set clearly, that might advance good policy. Mm. How does that relate to these governing images that you discuss in the book?
Go.
That was my question, basically.
Okay. Yeah, so the governing images very much align with the different goals. So, if the governing image is one of deviance, so drug use is deviant, it's abnormal, it's criminal, as the kind of governing image of drug use, then the goals will be to eliminate drug use, and the mechanisms will be a strong focus on law enforcement, prohibition, and so the kind of strategies that would be employed. So those, the sort of the governing image, the goals and the strategies kind of hang together, if you like. If, on the other hand, the governing image is one of that of ill health, that drug use is associated inevitably with drug dependence or addiction and ill health, and these people who use drugs become patients in the health system, then the policy goal is treatment. And is health, reducing the harms, the health harms, and then the strategies become, treatment and, medications and all of those sorts of things. So they can all sit together, but sometimes it's hard to surface the governing images. The strategies are pretty explicit. And to be honest, sometimes it's hard to surface the goals of what's trying to be achieved. Many countries do have sort of national strategic frameworks. So there are formal documents that say, this is what this country does in relation to drugs. This is what our goals are. But then there's the issue of the difference between the policy rhetoric and what actually happens on the ground. And how policy actions are actually, played out. So you can have good rhetoric but poor implementation.
Do you maybe have a good example of that disjunction between the rhetoric and the governing image, so to say?
So Australia's an example. Our national drug strategy has the goal of harm minimisation, to minimise harms, and it's an attempt to have a balanced approach, which occurs in many other countries, Switzerland, Canada, etc., where you balance law enforcement, prevention, treatment, and harm reduction. So it's very focused on minimizing harms with four pillars of activity that are balanced. The document talks about getting the balance right. In reality, on the ground, Australia has a really strong law enforcement approach. The investment in policing is substantially higher. It's like 60-70% of the drug budget compared to treatment and harm reduction. So there's no balance in the investment. And in terms of the actions in law, you know, one can be sentenced to quite long imprisonment for drug use in Australia. So even though the interest is harm minimizing the harms, the actual focus on the ground is much more about punishing people who use drugs.
Yeah, makes sense. But that's interesting because, excuse me, I mean, in Australia, you say that the practice is mostly law enforcement focused, but the rhetoric is about balance. But I do feel that at least historically, the governing image behind the international drug treaties, for instance, and still the rhetoric in many places is focused on law enforcement and prohibition, perhaps. Why do you think this? Because you cite in many ways that lots of these prohibition practices are not really effective. Why do you think this is so persistent?
I think there are a lot of reasons and different kinds of reasons. I mean, sort of first up, historically, the establishment of the international treaties, and there are fantastic scholars who have written about this who I cite in the book. You know, historically, the treaties were really arguably about race and power, not about drugs. And not starting with the idea that, oh, we've got a problem with drugs, with the harms from drugs, what do we need to do about it? I mean, it wasn't a policy process that started with identifying what the problem is. So the establishment of the treaties and the sort of prohibition era actually had not much to do with drugs per se. And then you get stuck. I mean, it's very hard to change these international regimes. And despite really strong advocacy from civil society and from experts, it's an incredibly slow grinding process to try and change the treaty system. There is a glimmer of hope. Last year, the UN agencies put out a joint statement in support of the decriminalisation of personal use of drugs, and the preference to treat drug use as a health and social issue rather than a criminal justice issue. But they're not going to change the treaties. So it's got a long, prohibition and the treaties have got a very long history. And so they're very stuck in that sense. Another reason I think is that people are afraid. People who use drugs experience a lot of stigma and are marginalised in all sorts of ways across globally in different ways and in different cultures. And I think that there is a fear that liberalisation will result in harm and damage to people's children. And I'm not dismissive of that fear. And I think the assumption, if there is a risk associated with doing something, parents, governments, want to manage that risk. And hence the idea that the best way to do that is to prevent use. Now, that's where the problem comes, because there are other ways of reducing risk. If you take the example of seatbelts in cars, here the risk is a fatal or non-fatal car accident. The solution was not to stop driving. The solution was to install seatbelts. And Australia and most other countries saw a dramatic reduction in the road toll as a result of the introduction of seatbelts. This is a classic risk management, harm reduction strategy. With drugs, the equivalent is not to say, well, let's not drive the car, let's not use drugs. Let's work out a way of reducing the risks. Because most people use drugs without experiencing harm. That's the thing I think that a lot of people don't quite get. So it's not inherently harmful to consume a drug. And not everybody experiences harm.
Yeah, I guess that might be an unpopular opinion, especially in policy circles.
Yeah, although, it's interesting. It is changing. Obviously cannabis is now legalized in many states in the US and many Uruguay and Canada, New Zealand, although the referendum failed. It'll probably get up next time. There's that policy activity which is really shifting the governing images of cannabis and the way in which cannabis is seen and the role that cannabis or marijuana plays. The other thing that's happening is there's a lot of work on psychedelic drugs and their role in improving mental health. So psilocybin, ecstasy, MDMA, psilocybin is mushrooms, and other psychedelic preparations, which I think is really shifting our idea. And in fact, the whole idea that drugs are harmful and risky sort of runs in the face of the consumption of alcohol, which we seem to be able to acknowledge is risky for some people and not for others. We manage the risks for those people that experience harms. So we seem to be able to hold that notion about the drug alcohol, but for some reason we can't hold that notion about cocaine or amphetamines or heroin. And yet the same principle is true.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
There are a few examples of countries that have taken a kind of an extraordinary position on when it comes to drug policy and a different take. You cite Portugal in several places, mm-hmm. for instance. What is it about their policy landscape that allowed for such an unorthodox take, so to say?
Yeah, look, every country is different, and every country is its own case example. in Portugal, there were significantly escalating drug-related deaths. There was a lot of concern about sort of poverty and social conditions. There's a very public drug injecting scene. And the then decision makers decided that they did need radical reform. This is in 2000, 2001, and introduced, you know, famously introduced the removal of criminal penalties for all drug use. What's important about what happened in Portugal was that they didn't just do that. They actually invested hugely in treatment, and they established these dissuasion commissions. So it wasn't like anyone could just use drugs. They were, if they were found using drugs, if they are found using drugs, an appointment is made with the Commission of Dissuasion, and they're given an assessment and education and information to reduce the risks. So it's not a free for all, and and importantly, the decriminalisation of personal use was associated with this enormous investment and infrastructure in assessment and education and treatment. And of course, it's been incredibly successful. When you talk with the people from Portugal, they say they were driven by evidence. They were driven by a commitment to reduce harms. And their context was such that, you know, the country was in trouble at that point in time. Whereas if you look at the United States and cannabis, that was driven by opinion through ballot initiatives, that this is the legalization of cannabis, which is a different example, and by a concern for government revenue. So a lot of the debates about legalizing cannabis were associated with the economic benefit, nothing to do with, you know, cannabis being a safe drug or people, you know, blah, blah, blah. So there the argument swung on the economy. I mean, there are other arguments as well. And if you look at Uruguay, it had nothing to do with public opinion. So cannabis in the US was mainly ballot initiative, so all about public opinion. In Uruguay, most of the people didn't want cannabis legalization. It wasn't popular. But the decision makers saw the nexus between the cannabis market and the rest of the illicit drug market and the amount of violence, the violence in the drug market, which was quite extreme. Obviously, South America, and they wanted to break that nexus. So the solution to breaking the nexus between the cannabis market and the violent illicit drug market was to legalize cannabis. So just those three examples, I think, show that every country is different and has its own context. And change is initiated sometimes for reasons that sit outside drug policy.
I do jump ahead a bit, I think, to one of your later chapters. You gave several country examples, and this, I always find this fascinating take on policy analysis when it comes to a comparison between different countries, because it seems like a daunting endeavor to compare objects as complex as different countries and their own policies. Just in big lines, what is a comparative policy analysis, and why do you think it might work?
comparative policy analysis is tr- trying to compare two different policy regimes, holding everything else equal, and trying to eliminate, you know, other difference. The reason why it's really important is because evidence does matter, and it provides the opportunity to really generate evidence about different policy regimes. If you don't have comparative policy analysis, what you're left with is modelling exercises or theoretical exercises about if then, and they're just not as powerful. As you alluded to, it's very hard to do. It's really hard to do well. And one needs to be very careful in taking context into account.
Yeah, makes sense. Let's see. So you also mentioned the policy modeling.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have maybe a, because you say that it's in a certain sense, it's maybe less grounded than the comparative policy analysis. Do you maybe have a success story of a good example of policy modeling, or maybe a failure?
So one example of this is some modelling work that we've done is in relation to methadone maintenance treatment, providing people who are opioid dependent with a medication. One of the key questions is the majority of people who inject drugs and who are in receipt of treatment for that are hepatitis C positive. And there's generally a view that we can now treat hepatitis C very successfully, but there's been a worry about reinfection. So the argument has been that if this is before the new hepatitis C treatment, so maybe this is not the best example now that I think about it. Anyway, policymakers have said basically if someone continues injecting drugs, we're not going to provide them with hepatitis C treatment because there's no point. They're just going to get reinfected and we're going to waste a precious medication resource. We did some modelling work that showed that it would be better to invest in treating people who were continuing to inject illicitly, as opposed to treating people who were already in methadone maintenance treatment, and that would have a bigger, that showed a bigger effect on cost and prevalence of hepatitis C. So in fact, the policymakers, instead of treating the hepatitis C for people who were already in drug treatment and not injecting, which sort of, that's what they were doing, they shifted to actually rolling out the hepatitis C treatment among the people who are currently injecting because there was the models show that there was better effectiveness overall. So it's kind of a counterintuitive finding from the modelling. But actually when you think it through, of course you want to treat the people who are actively injecting because they're the ones that are engaged in risk behaviour and spreading hepatitis C. So it kind of makes sense. So the model kind of provided the data, hypothetical data, to support a transition to a different policy for hepatitis C treatment. It's interesting about modelling, though, because I think COVID has given modelling a whole new sensibility. I mean, I think people now understand what it is, like the taxi driver and the layperson. They also understand the imprecision at some level and the uncertainty. So actually it's going to be really interesting. We need some of your sociologists who are listening to start studying the ways in which modelling has become an object of understanding in the public's eyes and driving, obviously, a lot of the responses to COVID, and what that then means for the future of modelling. I think it's a really interesting topic.
Yeah, maybe learning on this topic has sped up.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah.
So you also cite several challenges when it comes to data linkage and big data analysis, because they're, of course, they hold a lot of chances as well with a huge amount of data that's available overall. What are these problems that you identify?
So the frontier of data linkage has been around for a long time. Within health, within public health, the new frontier is data linkage with big data. So it's linking up someone's health records with their supermarket shopping, with their criminal history, with their transport app, how they move around the city, with their Fitbit. So data is everywhere, and it's all of those kinds of data. And now we're talking about the promise is that if all of these data are connected, we will be able to provide much better, in this case, health interventions or social interventions when we have all of that data. When we know that the 50-year-old has been to the liquor shop and purchased a lot of wine because we've got the bill, and then driven the car, and then gone to see his doctor, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, and we could then intervene in that person's life to reduce the likelihood of, you know, him experiencing significant harm. And on the one hand, there are people who are very excited about this possibility of big data being able to be used for public good. But it's terrifying. I mean, just in the example that I've given, there are privacy concerns. There are concerns about unnecessary intervention in people's lives. There are also concerns about the use of algorithms, which get it wrong. So a lot of these data are then generate an algorithm, which is then used by a doctor to make a prediction. The algorithms are trained on, you know, white middle class people, so they get it wrong a lot of the time. So there's lots of examples of algorithms gone wrong because the data's been wrong, the input data, the training data has been wrong. So that's a taste of what big data might look like. And take your Fitbit off and turn your tracker off on your phone, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, because it's all there.
These different kinds of evidence bases, so to say, when we look at your before last chapter, it's really a hopeful one. It's about how change might take place, and I do think, well, if I get it right, it's principally directed toward researchers, who, as you said, are in the presupposition that they make evidence and then they bring it to the policy makers, and then policy is correctly made, but that's not the case. And you speak a lot about different kinds of translation that might take place between the evidence and the policy side, so to say. Are there any good practices or any steps that researchers might take to give their results and their research a better valorization?
Yeah, I think I think there's lots that researchers can do, and I hope that there are some really good pointers in that chapter. I think one of the, I mean, there's a few key lessons. I mean, the first is to ask the right question at the very beginning of the research. If your question's not relevant to a current policy problem, or you haven't engaged with a decision maker right at the beginning, you're much less likely to have impact. I think co-design has become a buzzword, but actually it's really fundamentally important. So designing your research project with your end users as part of that. And then in terms of conducting the research, translating the research, I think academics have sort of, this might sound a bit rude and I apologise in advance, but have this sort of sense of being somehow objective and independent. And I would challenge that. I would challenge the idea that anyone is objective and independent. We all bring our worldviews and our values to whatever we do, whether it's research or clinical practice or whatever. And I think there is a role for academics to be advocates. And I describe in the book some of the both promise and challenge of advocacy work. And I think academics have been quite shy of the idea, well, we're not advocates, we're just in the business of providing the evidence in a kind of passive way. But evidence is not passive, and the way in which academics provide evidence is also not passive. And I think we could be braver about our values and about taking on advocacy roles as academics. And where that might not be comfortable or might be institutionally problematic, the second strategy is to work with advocacy organisations. So the first organisation that gets my research results is the drug user group or the Council of Social Services, the advocacy groups that actually know exactly how to get out there and bang the drum. I mean, that's what they do, and they do it really, really well. So giving them the results and letting them advocate in their voice with the messages that they want, I think is a really successful strategy for researchers.
Yeah, it makes sense. And, well, of course, the research cycle usually is a bit longer than the policy cycle, but it's a good idea to keep one eye on the salient policy topics that are currently
in the field. I mean, the one thing I would say that's a really important point in that chapter about making change happen, and also in the chapter on policy processes, there are these two different terms used. One term is knowledge broker and the other term is policy broker. And I try and explain how different these are. So a knowledge broker is someone who brokers knowledge into the policy process. So they take evidence and they, you know, translate that evidence for decision makers. And knowledge brokers are really important. And some academics are just nerdy and don't know how to communicate. They work well with a knowledge broker. So you can't assume, because you're a good researcher, doesn't mean that you're going to be a knowledge broker. So I advise researchers who are great researchers, who are generating great data, to work with a knowledge broker. That model of knowledge brokerage kind of fits with the evidence-informed policy paradigm and the idea that our job as researchers is to get evidence into the system, and that's what a knowledge broker does. The other model that I'm working with in the book is about the dynamic policy process interactions. And this is where you need what's called a policy entrepreneur or a policy broker. Their job is to match new solutions to problems and to politics. And it's a very active role. It's described in Kingdon's multiple streams theory and also in the advocacy coalition framework, two very common policy process theories that I explore in detail in the book. And here the assumption is that it's not that, that the policy broker will actively intervene to craft and shape the matching of a problem with a solution with the politics. That doesn't privilege the evidence-based policy paradigm. It's kind of a more it's an understanding of policy as policy making as being sort of dynamic interactions and networks of actors. So the researcher can either employ a knowledge broker or a policy broker. And the policy broker is a really active position for making change happen in a different way from the knowledge broker. Yeah, I hope I've explained that simply enough.
I think you did. So you just mentioned the how do you say that? The classical evidence-based policy paradigm versus the more networked sort of more horizontal policy making paradigm, or what policy is essentially. Your last chapter is called Democratizing Drug Policy, and there you quote Hannah Arendt stating, all political institutions are manifestations and materializations of power, and they petrify and decay as soon as the living power of the people ceases to uphold them. And I guess this implies a third take on policy, right? Or yet more horizontal model. Could you say a tiny bit about that?
Mm. Thank you for reading the Hannah Arendt quote. It's a beautiful quote. What to say about all of this? So the success of, to paraphrase Arendt, which obviously I can't do nearly as beautifully as she does herself, democracy thrives when there is active debate and when it is democratic and participatory. And fundamentally, that means that experts need to cede some power and create, and there needs to be the creation of opportunities for people to have a say in what to do about drugs, because that's democratic. And we need forums and venues, both formal and informal, for people to have their say. And I mean, I've worked in the drugs area now for more than 30 years, and everyone has a view. The school teacher that I talk to, the taxi driver, people at a party. I mean, sometimes I don't say what I do because I'm tired of talking about drugs, because everyone has a view, and that is fantastic. But we need to create venues and opportunities to surface those views, and to have them contribute to part of our democratic life and liveliness. And the reason we don't, I think, is because people like me have been scared that it will open the opportunity for vilification or for views to be expressed that I disagree with. But I think we need to face that fear. And indeed, the whole issue around the crisis in democracy, I quote A.C. Grayling and his recent book on the crisis in democracy, is precisely because of the sense that populism, right-wing populism, has taken over with Brexit, with Trump, maybe we're seeing something with some of the protests against vaccination. And the solution to that is not to repress those opinions or to insist upon an expert-led solution. In fact, that will only make it worse. That will only deepen the divide. The solution is to give voice to all of these views in a way that is ultimately productive. And I think that is terrifying for people who have worked in drugs for a long time. But I think it is our only way forward. Retreating back to experts and expert knowledge and losing the democratic voice, I think is very, very risky and won't advance good policy or the interests of the people, which is fundamentally what good drug policy is about, and democratic drug policy is about representing the interests of the people.
Thank you for that. Maybe because we've covered, I guess, most of the book already, I'd be curious still. You've mentioned that your current research, or you would like to steer your current research more towards values and ethics and how they intertwine with drug policy making. Are you already working on that? Do you already have a project running? Are you already writing a new book, perhaps?
I have started thinking about a new book on this issue, and I'm writing. But I'm writing a grant to get some research funding because I need research funding in order to pursue these agendas. So my next step is to convince a panel of experts that this is a worthwhile area for further scholarship.
All right. Thanks so much. So a bit in the future, but let's hope that it materializes, and then maybe we'll get the chance to talk about that as well.
Thank you very much. And I really appreciate the opportunity to talk about drug policy.
It's been a pleasure. All right. I wish you a great day.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.